Hello, all of you out there in Radio Land. This is KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. For our virtual listeners, we hope your computer is locked onto our website, kptz.org. The website's more than a way to listen to today's show. For example, you can find the biographies of all our hosts and DJs. You can look up calendar listings to see what's happening around town. You can even sample some of our earlier shows. Much of the original programming on KPTZ is currently available as a podcast. You know, double your listening pleasure. Listen to today's show as well as some earlier ones. I'm Marianne McNellis. This show is called Our Town. Have you ever wondered who the people are that you see every day around the area? Who were those two teenage types furtively smoking behind Aldridge's the other day? Wonder if they really think a super sniffer parent can't smell the smoke, even a few hours later. It's getting colder now, and the numbers of folk dressed as if they're in the 1880s is growing. Makes sense, I guess. But, you know, Port Townsend is a town that marches to a different drummer. The other night, we were down at the American Legion. There were copies of the New Yorker magazine on the reading table. And guess what radio station was playing? Nope. It wasn't KPTZ, it was NPR. Now there's a real good old boy or gal's radio station, eh? Jefferson County is full of all sorts of fascinating characters. This show, Our Town, tries to profile some of the singular personalities who live here. But the show is only a half hour long, which is definitely not long enough to do justice to some of our fellow citizens. So it's a synopsis. We try to get our guests to talk about their lives, their dreams, and how they ended up here on the western edge of the continent, able to look across the Strait of Juan de Fuca, right at Vancouver Island, Canada. Over time, we'll be talking with firefighters and foodies, bus drivers and baristas, the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. We try to find out what makes them tick and what they think about living in beautiful Jefferson County amid the deer, the otter, and even the magnificent soaring eagles. Today, my guest is Daniel Knudsen, well-known regional chef and retail manager at Key City Fish down in the Boat Haven. Daniel has been a guest on the show before. Last year, he talked about the Italian Feast of the Seven Fishes on Christmas Eve. Previously, he's talked about the founding families of Port Townsend and how they might have prepared a Victorian feast in the 1880s. Today, he's going to give us some timely tips for your Thanksgiving meal. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Glad to be here. How are you tonight?
Good. So before we start on those talking turkey stuff, Let's talk a bit about your background. Are you a local boy born and bred in Port Townsend?
Well, I was born in a barn in Millbury, Ohio. After I got out of high school, I went to the Vietnam conflict and ended up out at Fort Ord, California in 1974. I moved up here from Monterey, and I've been a Port Townsend boy ever since.
I see. Well, you know, Monterey's a nice place to be.
Not now, though.
Yeah. Okay, so back in 1974, when you first hit town, what was it like?
It was a very interesting town. All of the Victorian homes and all of uptown were all plywooded up. It was literally a ghost town uptown. The only thing that was happening at that time was a hippie commune at the town tavern and a couple bars on the water street, and that was it.
So what'd you do to support yourself?
The ferry was running from Seattle straight to Port Townsend. So I would get up and go down to the town tavern and shoot pool all day for my living to begin with, just to kind of unwind after such a wonderful military experience.
Well, obviously you drifted away from that. So what did you do?
Well, I've always been a chef. I started cooking when I was 14 at a place called the Dark Horse Restaurant in Findlay, Ohio, and progressed up to being the manager of the restaurant at 16 years old. I'm not one to sit around, kind of achieve goals quickly. So I started cooking here in Port Townsend at the Judge's Chambers, which was one of the first upper-end restaurants that Port Townsend had. And oddly enough, it was put together by all the judges in Port Townsend. Imagine so, that, right?
What kind of restaurant was it? What did they have?
It was all steaks, seafood. Really nice restaurant, but it didn't last long.
There weren't that many judges.
There weren't that many judges. And Port Townsend, like I say, it was mostly hippies and bikers and loggers. So you might have the occasional birthday meal or something, but everybody else did not frequent it very much. The next person to buy it was out of Bremerton, and it was called the Plumber's Landing, which, of course, was a way of humor for many people. Actually, Plummer was the captain of one of the first tall ships that came to Port Townsend.
So was that another upscale restaurant?
Yeah, it was in the same building of the same thought, but the finances started flowing through Port Townsend more, so we were able to sustain it for quite a bit more. Then I went from there to working with Gary and Sue Wall at a very popular restaurant in town called the La Fonda Mexican restaurant, and I was the head chef there from 1980 to 1990, 10 full years, till they decided they wanted to move back to Arizona.
Well, that was a good run.
Yeah, it was. And from there, I went out to the old alcohol plant with Ray and Gene. That was very cool at the time because it was also not just a high-end restaurant. It was a hotel and also horse racing. They had horse racing.
Really? I didn't
from
know
Seattle
that.
Upstairs. Yeah, you had to pay a fee to get in to play gamble on your favorite horse. Yeah, it was
so
crazy.
A little bit of gambling going
on
there.
Yeah, it was fun. Ray and Gene Hansen, they were wonderful people. I had a good time with them. Then I went from there out to the original Oyster House, another wonderful, beautiful restaurant. Not so much the restaurant itself, but where it was located right on Discovery Bay.
Nice.
Was phenomenal. And nice. I had a nice run there for quite a while. Other places was like Nancy's Place. I started every day would be a different national cuisine. So that was pretty popular, including the regular menu. I've had a pretty good run in Port Townsend. I guess what I'd say is I have a lot to be thankful for that I landed in this community. And it has really served my purpose well as far as putting out what I do the best and what I do and enjoy the most, which is cooking.
So at some point you ended up at the Manresa Castle.
I did, yeah.
So you worked there with yes. John Paul Davies.
Yes, John Paul Davies had taken over after they decided the Manresa Castle didn't want to do the food end of it. So John Paul took over, and I think he did a fantastic job. He had music in there. He had comedy nights. He had a really good menu in there. But as in many cases, once you start doing really well in something, other people think, well, I could just step in and take over that financially rich environment.
Yeah.
And it isn't. It's a personal thing. It's how much energy you put into something is how much energy that you get back out.
Well, the Manresa Castle has a reputation. And among the things it has a reputation for is the paranormal.
Yes,
there are ghosts there.
Yes.
So now, obviously, you spent quite a bit of time around there. What would you say about the otherworldly part of it?
I would say that there is credibility to that. I know we had the ghost adventures with Josh Bagan. I really haven't experienced any firsthand stuff, but I definitely have had that. I'm in the morning doing breakfast. Nobody's there. Nobody's up and around. I've had some creaks and different noises that I could attribute to that. I don't know. It's a good moneymaker. People come in to see it, don't they? So it's a wonderful thing. Personally, I have lived in 4 houses here in Port Townsend, and 3 out of the 4 had paranormal experiences more than the Manresa Castle. Up on Morgan Hill, there is a house that my wife used to clean, and upstairs, every one of the small rooms had a little steel ring in the floor. They would take guys that were shanghaied from the bars downtown and put them upstairs, chaining them up there. You would really start feeling some energies the further you went down the road. So there was probably 10 rooms, and then the end room was very dark and very black, and that's where I got the most energy out of the place, and I decided not to go in there.
I sort of had the impression that the shanghaied guys were shanghaied direct from downtown right out to the boats, but you're saying they held them uptown for a while?
I'm saying that whole building reeked of that, yeah. It looked like a staging area to me. And I've also had experience up on Lincoln where my son was born. We had a figure of an older lady that would cruise the house regularly. And I'm not a skeptic. I'm not somebody that disbelieves it, but sometimes things happen that you cannot ignore. It's there.
That's true.
And then when I was doing a plumbing project, there was a fake wall behind the fireplace, the bricks, and there was a little room in there with a single chair in the room, plywooded up, boarded up, so there was no access to this little room.
That's
just
weird.
Just kind of creepy, yeah.
How big was the room?
4x4.
That's weird.
Yeah.
That's really
weird.
And
right next to the fireplace chimney.
Very weird.
Yeah, it was.
Okay, well, okay, let's switch back to real time.
Sorry.
So you worked with John Paul
yes.
at the Manresa Castle, but at some point, John Paul decided to start Key City.
Well, John Paul already had Key City going really well. Okay. He started it down by the ferry dock. He had already progressed and moved down by Sunrise Coffee. He took on the Manresa Castle, and that's where I started chefing for him there. And then when it went down, I just switched over and came down to Key City Fish to help out down there and now, kind of taken over down there as
so
a retail manager.
At first, Key City was strictly fish, right?
Yes.
And then it diversified. So now it's fish, but it's also...
You can get the best beef, best lamb, best pork. I have all the fowl, chicken. We also have a program going right now where you can get fresh turkeys instead of frozen turkeys from Safeway. So it's a sign-up list. You go down, sign up it well ahead so that we have time to get them in and make sure that they're nice turkeys for you.
Right. You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. This show is called Our Town. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. Our Town profiles some of the fascinating people who live and work on the Olympic Peninsula. Today, my guest is Daniel Knudsen, master chef and retail manager down at Key City Foods in the Boat Haven. Today, we're going to be talking about turkeys, mainly. Well, actually, we're going to be talking about holiday feasts. And in the American culture, turkey plays a big part. All families have their own little variation on what they want to do at Thanksgiving. But let's talk about the big bird. So let's talk with the basic stuff of roasting a turkey.
I highly recommend brining your turkey ahead of time. I want the turkey to be placed in a pan and remove any excess fats from it. Make sure it's clean. It just serves better for when you're cooking it. You don't get as many brown pieces on the outside. So by brining it, that moistens the bird and will give you a much happier meal as far as having it be nice and moist.
Okay, well, so for those of us who are sort of amateurs at this, what do you really mean by brining? Explain it.
Brining is cold storing your turkey in water with a solution, some brown sugar, a coarse salt, some citric juices like orange rind in it, or whole oranges if you'd like. I've been known to put a little apple juice in mine. I always recommend adding like a couple capfuls of vinegar to the brine as well, and it just gives it a much nicer flavor.
How long do you leave it in?
You're going to leave your bird for 18 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then no matter how you're going to cook it, whether you're going to deep fry it, bake it, broil it, however, even barbecuing it, you want to take that bird out and take some paper towels and make sure you get it good and dry so that the bird is ready to receive whatever seasonings you're going to do so that it doesn't have a lot of excess salt on it.
Okay, here's a question I have. Turkeys are often pretty big. Kitchens are often pretty small. And refrigerators are pretty small. Where do you keep this sucker?
The idea is once you've got it in your brine, which I often recommend going down to the hardware and get yourself a 5-gallon bucket. Brine it in that overnight.
Mm-hmm.
The salt and the sugar should be boiled so that they've dissolved all the way so you don't have any large pieces of sugar or salt sticking to your bird.
But you don't put the turkey in the boiling water.
No, you do not. No. So what you're going to do is after you've dissolved it on the stove, you're going to put that solution that you've started there in the bucket. Then you're going to add a gallon of water and then some ice cubes. And the ice cubes are going to do the trick of keeping that bird nice and cold in there, but it's still being able to age in that brine. And it just makes for a nicer, more moist turkey when you serve.
Well, so do you leave it out?
Yes, I put it out in the garage.
Ah.
Or even on the kitchen floor. It's iced at this point, you know.
Of course, if you have a dog or a cat, you might consider
it. Well, you're going to have that lid. Yeah, you're going to put the lid on. But don't smash it down tight because they're so hard to get off.
Yeah, okay.
I hate breaking fingernails.
Yeah, right. Okay, so you've brined it. And
yes.
You take it out and you dry it all off.
Yes.
And then what?
So I don't know if you've ever been down to Key City or you're aware, but there are compound butters we make So what you're going to do is you're going to take your favorite seasonings that you like for your turkey, and you're going to take a pound of butter and put it in your food processor and get it fluffed up, and then add these seasonings to it. What you're going to do with this compound butter is you're going to loosen the skin on the top of the breast. You're going to take your hand and you're going to loosen it up, and you're going to add those under that skin. And what that's going to do is it's going to make such a nice, moist turkey breast, because we all know the breast is the hardest part to keep edible.
Yeah, well, certainly over the years, I've had some really dry turkeys at family events. The other day, you were telling me something about spatchcocking, and I'm not sure I know what we're talking about here.
What spatchcock is your butcher takes and goes down both sides of the vertebrae on a turkey and remove that vertebrae and then set it down and you pop the chest. So basically what you've got now is a 3-inch flat turkey with the legs on the side, the breast all down, and it just makes for about half the cook time. You can flatten it out like that and you can put it right on the dressing on the pan so that you get a nice crisp dressing underneath, and the turkey cooks in about half the time and still stays moist.
Well, cooks who don't know much sometimes really need help. Like the first time I decided to do a turkey, I knew all about the bag with the stuff in the big cavity, but somehow I overlooked the fact that there's a bag in the neck cavity.
Yes.
So I actually baked that bird with it in it, which was sort of a problem.
You're the only one that's ever done that, believe me.
But most of the turkey was fine. But that's a real rookie mistake.
Right.
We don't want that.
And those little packets with the giblets and stuff are often very nice to have for making
for the gravy.
The gravy and the dressing.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Let's talk a little bit about dressing.
Yeah, let's do. My favorite thing to do is dressing is, because there's a multitude of different recipes for your dressings, what I'll do is I'll take and make 3 different types of dressing, and I will put it in a single oven pan, a 3-inch deep oven pan, and I will put the first type on the far left and put a wax paper in there, put the next type in, put a wax paper. So you can have, instead of just one dressing, everybody can have their choice of which they like the best.
So what are the 3 you usually do?
I will do a giblet dressing, course, and then I am very fond of a nice Northwest oyster dressing in the middle. And then the other one is I like to take my cornbread, and I'll bake my cornbread a week before and let it set out and get kind of crumbly. Not like you want to serve it at a meal, but you want it to dehydrate a little bit. And I like to make a cornbread with jalapeno and cheddar in it for another dressing. So, you know, I'm kind of diverse on my dressing ideas, but I do realize that people have different tastes. So I'm always looking to get feedback as to which one they like the most, and know that that's for future reference.
Well, odds are most of us aren't going to do 3 dressings. Yeah. We're probably going to pick one.
Well, then I think you should step up to the plate.
Well, I'm out.
I'm always encouraging people to step out of their comfort zone. Okay.
But you told me the other day something interesting, which was basically you can make the dressing ahead of time, the day before.
Yes.
And you can just leave it in the fridge and therefore clean up all that mess before you even get around to the turkey.
I am a total advocate of prepping all things prior to. I want that turkey, when it comes out, to rest with aluminum foil tent over it, or even a paper bag tent over it. That gives you another hour to have all these prepped up dressings, sweet potatoes, all the other things that we like so much, you know, the string bean carrot mushroom thing.
No.
You can put those all in after you're done with your turkey. And that way you're not rushing anything, because there's nothing worse than getting stressed about how the food's coming out. It's a little planning goes a long way for having your food come out, so you can enjoy it too.
And you said you could put parchment paper under the dressing in the turkey.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
That appeals to me, much less messing around
here. And that spray Pam stuff is wonderful for anything that you think is going to stick in a pan.
Because,
and don't forget to delegate. You're doing all the cooking. People are more than happy to help do some dishes after the game.
Good. Well, okay, so far we've been concentrating on roasting yes. your turkey, which in fact is probably what majority of people might do. But let's talk about a couple of other ways you can do it.
Let's talk about deep frying your turkey.
Okay.
Yeah, that's always fun. Deep frying has caused a lot of problems with how it's done. If you follow my recipe on taking the brine and making sure that your turkey is tied up and dried off, because water will expand and blow that oil out of the pan. So we want it really dry. If you're going to deep fry, you want to have at least twice the amount of room in your deep fry pot as you do oil. Even just the oils of a turkey are going to create moisture. So you want to make sure that that moisture is contained in that pot. Make sure you have lots of room. I always recommend, if I'm deep frying a turkey, I have a syringe that I inject liquids into the turkey breast and in any of the meat sections so that they stay nice and moist, because deep frying actually pulls moisture out of the turkeys at the same time it sears it in. I just want everybody to be really safe when they do that.
But this is an outside-only event,
yes,
right?
Yes, it is, please. I'm sure there have been people that tried it not outside, but the amount of steam that comes out of it and the oils, you don't want that on the inside of your house.
Yeah, I would think so. And given our climate at this time of year, usually it's not all that charming outside for deep frying things.
Yeah, pretty much you have to be really dedicated if you want to deep fry a turkey in this weather.
And that raises the other issue. What about barbecuing your turkey?
I love barbecuing my turkey. So what you're going to do is you're going to follow the main game plan. You're going to have a Weber or a Krager or something where you can put your turkey in your regular oven pan. I like to have a catch pan so that it's elevated off of the actual barbecue surface so that the liquids can catch and you can use that to baste. What I like to do is start out by, again, making sure my bird is extremely clean. I'll put a package of different types of herbs inside of the bird, some apples, some oranges, potatoes, carrots, celery, or your mirepoix is always good. But you want to add a little bit of that so that the steam from that keeps the bird nice and moist as well. So what I do when I'm doing that, I'm putting it in my catch pan. I'm putting it upside down, which is kind of counterproductive as far as oven baking it. But I want to get the bottom of it browned really well. So I'm talking about putting it in a 350 Weber for about an hour upside down. And then after that is done, you're going to want to turn it over, baste it again, and give it another hour with the breast up and basting it often.
Okay. Are you talking about the example you're using, a whole turkey or one that's been spatchcocked?
This is a whole turkey.
A whole turkey.
But spatchcocking is much nicer and easier to do. So,
I would think so.
I mean, either way. But if you're not familiar with how to spatchcock and you don't have me hanging around to do it for you, you know, it works either way. But I like the spatchcock.
Okay, well, I would assume that in the case of both the deep frying or barbecuing, you're not putting your dressing in the bird. You're doing it in the oven, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And also, like the spatchcock, I'll use a 3-inch pan to cook the turkey in, and I'll also have that dressing underneath it so I get a nice crisp crust on my dressing, because when you're broiling the spatchcock, all the juices of that are going to go into the dressing. So that's something to keep.
Sounds yummy.
But like you said, make sure you have the parchment paper or a spray pan so it's easy to clean up.
Right.
You know, give yourself that benefit.
But in the case of doing it that way, you don't have those juices to make the all-important gravy.
Right.
So
I always recommend having either buying some chicken backs and making your own stock. The bouillon cubes are nice. There's packets of, you know, chicken stock that they sell at Safeway. And just keep an eye on your sodium intake with the stocks that you get. Look at the back and see how much salt or nitrates they've added to it. Just a good practice.
Okay. So how do you make sure your gravy doesn't come out all lumpy?
Okay. That's a really good question. Most people, if they followed their grandparents' recipe, the old school, is a quart jar with about 1/4 the way filled with water and about a half a cup of flour. And you shake it up really good so that you don't have any clumps in it. But the way I like to do it is I like to take 1/4 pound of butter, 1/4 pound of flour. I like to put that in a pan and fry it till it fluffs up pretty and white. It's going to be yellow until it gets cooked. You don't want to go past brown because that's Cajun cooking. But you do want to get it nice and white. And then you're going to take your stocks and start adding it to that roux. That's a roux, R-O-U-X, French. until you get it to the consistency that you like.
Okay.
Real easy and fast and beautiful. It always comes out good. And keep some on the stove. Fill your little gravy pitcher, but keep some on the stove in a bain marie, a double boiler, so it's not overcooking. It isn't getting scorched, because there's nothing worse than scorched.
Yeah, well, you can never have too much gravy.
That's right, exactly. For later when you're having your sandwiches and stuff.
We've mainly been focusing on turkey, but some people like a different kind of bird or something else. What are some of the things you could do alternatively?
If I'm just cooking for two for a nice Thanksgiving night, I'm going to use a boned quail. That's a very light, delicate meal. Sometimes people don't want to get too full. So we have quail. We have geese. A nice Christmas goose is always nice. We also have rabbit, duck, duck hindquarters, duck breast, any which way. If you come in and you want to learn how to do a duck confit, which is a duck roasted in its own fats, I can teach you that too.
That takes a fair amount of work, I think.
Not really. No. I think, you know, people are more overwhelmed with what they think it's going to be as opposed to just making it.
Yeah, you're
right. In a restaurant setting, if I'm making a beurre blanc, I'm doing a half a gallon of it. But if I'm doing it at home, I'm only making a small pan of it, and it's so easy and fast. It's when you start making large amounts is when it starts getting kind of crazy.
Okay. Well, no, we're running short on time, but let's spend a moment or two to talk about dessert, one of my favorite parts.
I think you and everybody else, too. Most of your, like, your candied yams, and those are supposed to be entrees, but those in themselves are kind of a dessert as well. Yeah. My first priority on making any pies is making a pie crust using pig lard, salt, flour, and a quick spin through the garden. I don't want it over mulched. And that, in turn, also makes it light and flaky, which is what we all love. We like that crispy, crunchy crust.
Yeah, you told me you're not supposed to overwork your dough.
No, you don't overwork it. If you overwork it, it's going to cause problems. It's going to be like Play-Doh. And that's not what we want.
We don't want that.
No. We have all kinds of berries. Apples are in season right now. Some really nice pears. You know, don't be afraid to experiment and do apple berry pies or a cobbler, which is merely a pie with the crust on top. Really fun, really easy.
And pumpkin's a mainstay.
Pumpkin pie, of course. Try a sweet potato pie. It is amazing. It's one of my favorite pies.
I don't know. My favorite part's the whipped cream.
Yeah, of course. I totally agree 100%.
Okay. Well, Daniel, we really are running out of time
here.
I want to thank you so much for being on the show.
It's always a pleasure.
Sure, our listeners got some really good ideas, and they're now all hungry and going into their kitchen, rummaging around, trying to figure out what to eat. I also want to thank my partner, John McPherson, the man in the glass booth, editor and producer of Our Town. He's the one who smooths out all of our mumbles and grumbles, makes me and my guests sound ever so intelligent, much more eloquent than we really are. I also want to thank three people who are deeply devoted to this station: Larry Stein, program director; Kate Ingram, station manager; Robert Ambrose, chairman of the board. I also want to thank you, the listener. You're very important. We need your support, listeners. We need your donation, and we always need volunteers. So come on down and volunteer. There are lots of things to do here, and we always looking for more money. We'd like to move out of our world headquarters here in a trailer in the parking lot of Mountain View School. We're renovating a building up at Fort Worden, and it's going to be fabulous, but, you know, it's not cheap. And the contractors always charge more than they say they will, and it always takes longer than they say it will, but that's life. So thank you so much for listening. I'm signing off for today, but please keep listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production, created by Marianne McNellis and engineered by John McPherson.